Hello out there, this is Andrew Lugoldham, welcoming you back to our Sounds and Vision Pod Chat. I want to thank you for all the wonderful send-ins and opinions you've given us all the pleasure on our guest for the last 2 weeks, Mr. Johnny Mann. Today's guest is my good friend, Mr. Jonathan Becker. Jonathan is a photographer, mainly known for his work until recently with Vanity Fair. Then when they dropped one of their colors and went schlocky, Jonathan was no longer there, or some version of that. Jonathan has worked from the Amazonian jungle, first encounter photography of members of the Llano mummy tribe. And from that, he darts into Buckingham Palace and does the Prince of Wales and Camilla Parker Bowles together. Bowles, I'm sure it should not be pronounced by that, but Camilla will forgive us if she is listening. Jonathan works with old cameras. And for those of you who work with new cameras, the phone upon which you may be right now, you're in for an edutaining lesson of how to improve the stuff that you take. In Vanity Fair, Annie Leibovitz and other people were assigned the flash people. Jonathan was assigned the money. He took money and culture and heritage pictures. Please join me with my good friend, Mr. Jonathan Becker.
Well, just before we started this little chat, you took a few pictures of me.
Yeah.
A few is the operative word.
Yeah.
And
plenty.
Yes, but
more.
not the. Here I'm going to go on to wobbly ground, because one's experiences in my life is either really early, where there was someone as direct and plenty was a few, or someone like Terence Donovan or Brian Duffy, to the malaise of today, where it can be a 2 hour warm up. I mean, a rock and roll photographer would spend not only 2 hours getting you in the mood, but himself in the mood.
That's very undisciplined.
Yes. Okay, good.
I started with Brassai, my great hero.
Yes.
I used a plate camera.
Yeah.
So he knew what he was doing before he did it. And he had three, for a portrait, he had three plates. And it was a bit like John Phillips. He'd think in advance. He's another Virgo, like me. And he knew what he wanted before he did it. He didn't expend film warming up. And it's expensive, by the way. If every time I click the button now, it's $5 to process, not even to make a print. So if a roll of 12 is already $60, and then if I were taking pictures, you imagine? Click, 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 that's $100.
Those three plates, what goes into making sure all those three...
He had that moment of great excitement, and he didn't feel it, he didn't take a picture.
Oh.
And the moment of, this... And then he made it, he did it. And when I did his portrait for interview, way back, and I decided I would do with the same Voigtlander that he used. And I had three plates. And we did it in front of the Mayflower Hotel. Remember that on the west side?
I loved
it. And so we went out on the street to take the picture. I'm a little nervous. I knew him very well already for 4 or 5 years. But here I am taking his picture, which I'd done before, but not with his camera.
Huh.
And I took the three plates, and then he said, let me see what you did. And so he goes back and looks through he said, you go stand where I was. We're about the same height.
Oh, so he'd have to see it the same way.
No, we just looked through the viewfinder,
the
electrical cameras. And he just instinctively lifted the handle on the tripod. He tilted the camera down just an inch or two, maybe an inch and a half. And he said, look. And he went back. Lo and behold, all the lines had changed. The composition changed. It was so much more plastic, just with a little like this. And I thought, it's something that's in your... I'm more like that now. But I was a kid then. I was 20.
Yeah. What is the more like that now from... The more like that now.
It's just facility that comes from experience.
Yeah.
But he knew what he wanted before he would do something. That I learned from him. Uh-huh. Don't waste. Sometimes I'm on assignments... And it's difficult because you don't necessarily have a connection with the subject that you're assigned to photograph. And it may be people have been very difficult to talk with, even. Some people don't understand. Because I don't do mostly movie people or theater people. I do. Sometimes I'll waste some film just making them thinking that it's just to break the ice a little bit. but I know I'm wasting it. Sometimes I don't put filter.
But a lot of the people that you photographed in that way, they almost seem to be, because of their job, be it in royal families, in businesses, or they're one of the professional jobs is not letting you in.
In that case, it's better not to take any pictures
for a while.
Because then they wonder. No, they actually calm down because then they want their picture taken more. Okay. Because what are you doing? Because they're used to people coming in and taking thousands of pictures. So they're more facile about the whole thing when the time comes to actually take the few pictures. And then you've thought about what you want.
Yeah.
And you've been looking at them and you've been studying them and then talking with them. And then you only need a few pictures.
Right.
Like right now, look at you right there. You're looking at me. You're wondering, you're looking at me like, wondering, what the hell is he talking about?
No, I find it because...
But that quizzical look is brilliant.
Yeah, it's because it's to say I'm lining it up in my brain with what I would be looking for when I was making records because you're putting the vocalist in a version of what you're talking about. One of the stories, I think it was Bill Wyman on the Stone, said one session that Andrew made all the difference. We were recording in the cavernous RCA studios in Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
And when it came down to us doing ballads, like Play With Fire or something, I did a lighting plot. I mean, they're not going to do a ballad the same. I didn't think this then. It just seemed automatic. Close the studio down, make it more intimate, make it like a club as opposed to a big stadium. Because in that recording studio that was put to handle 40 musicians, that's different energy. Now we want that seductive...
Intimacy.
Yes.
That's what I'm talking about. It's intimacy. When you're intimate with what, then it's time.
And you're reading the faces.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I do because I am in a number of countries where I don't speak the language.
Yeah.
Or can't be bothered.
It's all in the eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, oh yeah, it's wonderful. And I imagine it's like the people in front of you, you may sit, while that moment comes when they want their picture taken, there's probably a number of pictures which you could have taken, but you haven't got it ready. They're there for you.
Well, you can go back and get them.
Yeah.
It's strange. Things repeat themselves. And then it's better.
Yeah.
It's even better than what you thought. It's funny how it happens. I can't... It's hard to articulate these visual things. It happens very quickly when it happens. It's a 60th of a second, 125th of a second, 500th of a second sometimes.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. It's got to be that 60th of a second. Not if you take all the 60th of a second, it's funny. Click, 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 click. You go and look at the whole roll of film, there's nothing there. It's a question of will. I know what I want from you. I can have a camera and take pictures till hell freezes over, and it'll be terrible. But if I'm looking at you right now and I see something, I definitely see a picture of you right now. In this light, I might move it a little bit. I know what I want. I only need one frame. Just give me one frame, and I've got it. And I'll be sure to get it. It might take me 5 minutes, because I know I'll need a tripod here. And I know I'll need this. And I know... You know, I get that look back on your face, and it may take me a while to talk you into that face again.
Okay, talk me into it. That's right as well.
But I only need one frame, because when I get, maybe I take two, maybe three, because I screwed something up with it, shook the lens or one thing or another, but I don't need more than three.
But you've recognized the moment.
Yeah, I've got it. I like it.
Right.
Then I don't care.
Then like,
yeah, but...
That's the key to me in this committee-driven world, that there's... Not enough.
Oh, I don't care about what anybody else thinks. And I've always had this. It's, you know what? I think if there's one thing that made me confident from the first days, I don't know where it came from, but I knew when I started in my teens, even before 12 when I started doing this, I knew when I had something that I liked. It didn't matter to me. I knew if it was good to me, all I cared about, I was happy. That's what I wanted in a picture.
At that age?
Maybe not 12, but by the time I was 18.
But you knew
18. Oh, no, I knew. When I got it, I thought, yes, this is it.
I knew what I liked.
It made me happy. What am I going to tell you? It makes me happy that I don't care about anybody else.
That's perfect. I mean, I knew what I liked from the first time my mother took me down into the undergrounds in London, and I saw cinema posters, and I went, whatever this is, I want.
Turn you on.
Yeah. Exactly. And more turned on by Daryl F. Zanuck Presents. Didn't want to be Victor Mature. Was a drawn to, you know,
the producer.
Yeah. And let it go because I was happy doing PR and things like that. But then it comes back, but you recognized it. You never, ever
forget it. You light on it.
Yes.
It gives you light.
Yes.
It is strangely, there were very few times when I could, because I got good at it on assignment. That's hard on assignment because it's not your inspiration. It's what you're told to get inspired by.
Right.
It's a bit like having to be a gigolo or something.
Okay.
Yes. Which I would be terrible at this. Right. I'd be terrible. I found a way of getting interested in people that I didn't necessarily have any connection to. Then, weirdly, the ones I had the most difficulty with through all of these times with the magazine and whatnot were professionals. Because they were so guarded.
Yeah. Professionals, just actors.
Not all of them. Some of them. But there's a... There are so many walls and layers and the vanity, and they want to see. I can't get them to react or talk, or the image is so important. It's not that important.
No. One of the books I bought the great book on Frank Sinatra, which I'll send you a picture of so you know to get it, written by the guy called Elliot something, who managed him the last 20 years, who was involved in the Westchester thing with the photos with the Gambino family.
Oh, the big...
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And the book is great. There's a few sad things in it because it seems Frank was, Mr. Sinatra was on antidepressants too long.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And his wife, allegedly, didn't want him to stop taking them. And it was one of the things that started to cause his memory. Now, I mean, I know from my drug taking days.
Right.
That you sitting there and say, Doctor, I've been on this one for 6 months already. It's clashing with these other two. What should we do about it?
And they're all different colors and shapes and sizes. And no one knows what's in those funny shaped pills.
No.
That's sad. I didn't know that.
Yeah, but he also managed Liza Minnelli and gives it to her.
Oh, yeah.
But the saddest part is him towards the end at his... You photographed him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. A
couple times.
Yeah. What time of his...
Oh, later. Later in the... I suppose the first time must have been the very early 90s when he was in Monte Carlo for the Red Cross Ball. Uh-huh. Even after Grace died, he went back into her memory and into stuff and sing.
Yeah.
For the Red Cross. It was a big draw. And I was there with Ann Hurst. It was the very last thing I did at Town and Country magazine. Yeah. It was a social thing. It was her family. And so I went with her to do it. And he was very specific about being photographed. He said, you can have one frame. But this already took 3 days and nights to get him to agree to this. 3 days and nights at the bar, the Hotel de Paris, drinking all night long at a table just exactly this size, like 20-inch, you call that kind of a table? A bar table.
Yeah.
The three of us sitting around. There had been 30 people. He'd taken everyone to dinner. Every night he took everyone to dinner. And
he had an overhead.
Huh?
He had an overhead.
He insisted. I don't know why. It was just by the end of 3 nights in a row. And in the background, I remember fuzzy bodyguards, because in the middle of the table was a Jack Daniels, and like a wine bottle, pouring that much, and the ice. And I can't drink more than two or three of these. It tastes like cough syrup.
Right.
It's sweet.
Yes.
But he's insistent on it, and that's what I had to... I remember the one thing, and he knows that you won't remember anything, so you can have these great conversations, and it's fun, and he tells a story, and you tell a story, and actually, it's a great way of being, but no way you could possibly remember anything that he'd said. And you can't take notes, and the moment I most remember about him terrified me was that late at night, one of these nights, and every night I was picked up at the end by the staff or the hotel, they had to carry me home to me. I couldn't. He'd get up and walk out some back door that he knew about, and go up. I'd be sitting there with Anne.
Right.
She could walk, but I couldn't. Anyway, I was telling a story, and he said, what do you got? That's the line, one line I remember, because he looked at me with those, and the eyes looked like there were diamonds in them. Huh. I'm not kidding you.
No, no.
There was a sparkle.
Yes.
And he looked at me with his twinkling eyes. He said, "What?" It was squinting a bit. He said, "What do you got?" I didn't know what to say. He said it three times. And the third time, he said, "What do you got?" His eyes flashed on my glass. I thought, oh, my glass was full. The ice was melting. And he didn't like that. So I said, "Well, I got Jack Daniels." And he said, "No." This was late. He said, "When I say, 'What do you got?' you say, 'I got Daniels.'" Okay. And what he really meant was drink that glass of wine. So I, scotch or bourbon. So I did. And it's not bourbon, it's sour mash or whatever. He terrified me. I saw him again in Las Vegas. It was the very end of the Desert Inn. Keeley Smith was playing in the little room.
Loved Keeley's.
Oh, yeah. I knew her since I was a little boy because she, Julie, in Showboat. And my mother was Ellie. It was a smaller part.
Okay.
And I traveled. This was summer stock. We went all over the Valley Forge, Camden, all these tents. And I was six. And Keeley Smith was in it. And she was very cool those days. I met her much later on in Palm Springs. And she lived with the guy who wore the...
Yes.
The new husband wore... He wore a black T-shirt that came down below his knees. He was funny. He was in the jukebox business.
She had an affinity for...
And he lived in the basement. They had a whole recording studio down there.
I met her... I was recording the Rolling Stones at RCA.
Yeah.
On Sunset.
And she was beautiful.
Oh, I know. And a guy who was a producer called Jimmy Bowen was married to her now. And we didn't allow many people in, but he was coming in and he was trying to get me to record Dino, Desi, and Billy, which included the sons of Dean Martin.
Desi Arnaz?
Yes, the sons. And Dino Martin Jr.
And Billy...
Henchy. I don't know. He went on to be... I don't know who Henchy Sr. was. Anyway, there's no way I could do it. Even if I wanted to, the Rolling Stones would have laughed me out of the room. You want to record Dino, Desi, and Billy?
Yeah.
But Keith Smith was just... This is 65. Was so beautiful.
She was cool.
He was very cool.
She was really cool.
Yeah. And we weren't... As we'd only been coming to America for a couple of years, we were not used to that type of cool. I'd probably witnessed that a British version of that type of cool the first time I was in a room with Princess Margaret.
I think she was cool, Keeley Smith, in a way. You see, he did have that Indian blood.
Yeah.
Wild. It was like John Phillips.
Yeah.
Cherokees.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. John Phillips is something that we should definitely touch on. As I think you changed both our lives, the ability of the man to write and to live. The last time I saw him was when the Mamas and Papas were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
When was that?
96, maybe. Yeah. The Waldorf Astoria. When the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was still a glorious private party before it was a televised Tom Hanks event. And he came in on two crutches.
I missed the last 20 years of him.
So did he.
No, I mean, sadly.
No, I'm sadly, but he was, as Lou Adler said, I said, "How's John?" And he said, "Still looking for other parts of his body to finish." I first met him at 65. But you don't, at that age, like I said, I was 20, 21. And you don't ask people then how old they are.
Right.
But he already had 10 or 12 years on us. He was born 34 or something like that.
Oh, my goodness, he'd be in his 80s.
Exactly.
Yes. Is that right?
Yeah.
This time goes by. I was a kid. He hired me to paint his house. He was here with Genevieve Wade.
Yes.
And they were the toast of New York when they first got here.
Yeah.
They got here. They lived at Avedon's house. And I was in love with her, I'll tell you the
truth. Well, she was...
She just did. She cast a spell on me.
Yeah.
I mean, I was 20, too. I was 20.
Yeah.
And so he hires me. I was shiftless, and I needed something to do. It was 1974, 73, 74. And he rented this house, beautiful little Stanford White House, right next to the Carlisle Hotel. And he wanted to paint it. And I remember I got this very special paint from Sweden or something, Mazuri oil paint. I said the walls would really shine. It was. I did the kitchen first.
Huh.
I don't know that I got anywhere but the kitchen, but it's just. And I photographed Genevieve there, and him, and then the kid. Tamerlane was just born, and China was so little, and everyone was in and out of that house. All the pop star, all the people you
know.
And they got Andy Warhol to produce the show with the songs from the record.
Right.
Called The Man on the Moon.
That's right, yes.
And I think Paul Morrissey directed it.
Yep.
And it was in this posh little theater off Broadway, on Broadway. Everything was done with such style. And then it was springtime for Hitler. It lasted one night. It was a disaster. The reviews came in. I mean, it was camp, you know.
Yeah, yes.
But no one got it.
But there were so many there. So many shows that went.
No, but this was great. It was. I loved the show. I was the only person that loved it.
Oh, that's not enough.
But I was, because I loved Genevieve.
Yes.
Yeah.
See, as you know, I'm fascinated as to where it all came from with him. Because to have got to California in 1965, and when Lou Adler said to me, come to the office, I've got something I want you to hear. And the offices were where all the record company offices and the talent agents were, then like on South Beverly Drive. Nothing was north of Wilshire Boulevard. All that sort of Doris Day area.
Right. The flats.
Yes, yes. And they were in the office of Dunhill Records, and they must have sung 18 songs. This is before they recorded California Dreaming. They had already written every hit they were going to have.
The same four.
Yeah. And so I heard on that one day, California Dreaming, Monday Monday, Creek Alley, their versions of Words of Love, their version of Dedicated to the One I Love.
Right.
They had the whole, this was a kind of change in pop music. They had the whole repertoire down so that once they had a hit, they could go ballistic and buy things like Nelson Eddy and Jeanette McDonald's House.
Right.
And Party Party.
He planned it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was brilliant.
Yeah.
He was a brilliant genius of a human being. He had it all figured out.
And you could, on occasion, stand in the same cubicle as him. But it was like a sort of time zone that he controlled. When he turned up at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, on the crutches, he thought, and you would think, he's going to go on stage and do California Dreaming?
He did?
Yeah. But that night in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame at the Waldorf, they had three girls to sing Cass's part.
Oh.
Michelle was there, Denny was there. But John, you'd never know that 5 minutes before he was on a crutch. Once he was on stage, could have been the Ed Sullivan Show.
He came to life.
He came to life. Not unlike when I saw, you remember Les McCann, the jazz?
Yes.
But you see him being carried on stage, and then once it starts. See, this is one of the keys, because I know you and I keep track of each other with our health. Recently, when our good health, deciding that musicians who rely on the health they feel on stage don't live very well off stage.
That's theater people of every stripe.
That's what?
Theater people.
Yes.
Of every stripe.
Yeah.
My mother's like that. She's not working. It's a disaster. She's 90.
Yeah.
But she knows she's got a gig, which she does.
Yeah.
And she can do another show with Hal Prince. And you know what? She's 23 again. She's disciplined. She's a dancer, but
right.
It's all in preparation for the gig. She lives for those moments that she can work. And she loves what she does. And it is a tonic.
Yes. But isn't there a time when he catches up how much preparation it takes to be physically able to do it, or is it just the adrenaline?
John had many years of obscurity towards the end. No?
Yes, yes.
And that can lead to bad ill health.
Yes. Either you're going to have the most wonderful day anyway.
But if you've got this stage thing,
yeah, then
And you don't got a stage, then those days are long and detrimental to the health.
I think that...
It can be.
I mean, an obvious exception is, of course, is Mick Jagger.
But he works all the time.
Exactly. No, but he works at the work all the time. And then people forget that one of his golden gifts was his father, who was a PT instructor.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And his mother sold cosmetics door to door. Avon Calling. So he had the whole deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a compliment, Mick. If you go on to YouTube or Google or whatever, and you write him, because then he was, when he was a young boy, he was Mick Jagger.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, Joe Jagger, physical training or PT class with Mick Jagger. The father used to have a television show. And in the afternoons, for children who've just come back from school, and there is a classic one where the father's there with lots of young boys with gym slips or gym trousers and things. And he says, now young Mick, and Mick doesn't say it's my son. He said, now Mick will scale the rocks.
It was in his DNA,
all
of this.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that probably his level of feeling not quite up to par begins a lot earlier than mere mortals.
At a higher standard.
Yeah. Or as L. Ron Hubbard said, clear body, clear mind.
He used to go to visit in the Adirondacks with an old friend of mine, Whitney Tower, who didn't have any of his discipline or background and is not in great shape today, but I love him. And they would, but he would go, this was like 35 years ago.
Mick would go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's very fancy up there. It's a Vanderbilt. They owned the Adirondacks,
right,
basically. And they had many lakes. They'd go from one lake to another on a seaplane and land at the dock of another cabin where they'd spend a day fishing or whatever they would do. And it was lovely. And I used to go up, not when he was there, but not when Mick was there, but I went up other times. But he was there. He would run every day.
Yeah.
And jog. And it was total discipline. It was athletic.
Now, with Marianne Faithfull, when she was very young and we were recording her for the first time, I didn't have the money to record her. And I got the money from Lionel Bart because he had a lot of money then. So we formed this company and we were going to we had to do one of Lionel's songs. Now, Marianne Faithfull then, and some might say now, but I won't, technically cannot sing. She's an actress. But most white people, it is acting. I mean, if you've got pipes like Joe Cocker, you can't help yourself. But other than that, Rod Stewart, don't tell me that he was born with that voice. He developed it.
Yes, he knew sounds it like it.
Exactly. And the song by Lionel Bart was absolutely awful. But we had to do it, because he was paid for it. And I had a little song that Mick Keith and I had written as the B-side, Cool as Tears Go By.
Oh, yeah.
When it came, I pretended that the first one was good enough. It was horseshit. It was just terrible. It was like a reject from East Side Story. Never mind West Side Story. It was Lionel at his worst.
Uh-huh.
But then you get worried, Jonathan, because so I can sing you that song. And nowadays, go, wait a minute, if I can still sing you the song, maybe it was good. Because you really said, I remember that piece of crap.
Well, that was the definition, if you remember
exactly.
The head.
Yeah, right. And so I can, I don't know how, but anyway, it's right, and all that. I can remember the first song that Brian Jones wrote that we thought was terrible.
Uh-huh.
Mind you, the ordeal that we had to put Gene Pitney in a hotel room with him to try and drag a song out of him.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was very weird. But then it came to cutting this little B-side, As Tears Go By. And the musicians breathed such a sigh of relief to not be listening to this heinous thing that we'd been recording, that you could hear that sigh of relief as they go into As Tears Go By. And it transported As Tears Go By from being a B-side to an A-side.
What was the A-side?
Never came out. It was the piece of shit that Lionel wrote that she couldn't see. I don't know how. It came out on one of those ABCO reissues, of everything Marianne shouldn't have done, shouldn't have recorded.
As Tears Goes By was hers originally?
Well, yeah. She was the first person who sang it, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And it was a Mick Keith song edited by me. But it was just meant to be the B-side. But it had... thank God we're not playing that other piece of music. And you can hear that physical relief. So it's almost like having a picture taken.
Sure.
You can... That physical relief of the musicians playing... adding something that was never planned, and I just said, this is top 10.
And it was.
Yeah. And we remained top 10. Well,
you know, it was a very beautiful song.
Yes, it was. Yes. With no thought at that time, given that it's basically a song maybe for an older woman to sing, but the dichotomy, the question of opposites is what made it attractive. I had met her at a party, and...
Timeless.
And God, whoa, look at this. And I knew she could sing for two reasons. Sing in quotes. One, because of her speaking voice.
Uh-huh.
And what I aligned it to was the fact that I remembered seeing Grace Kelly lying on her back in a dinghy with Bing Crosby in High Society.
Oh, yeah.
Singing, she just sang the bridge of, "For you and I have a guardian angel on high with nothing to do." And he takes the pipe out. That was magical, Grace Kelly. It was magnificent because the score was great. The soundtrack was that. Never mind Easy Rider. The soundtrack of High Society was nothing but hits. No, it was great. And I knew because of Grace Kelly that Marianne Faithfull could sing. And we had a hit. And that's it. And we've had a hit with you, Jonathan. Thank you very much.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for being on Sounds and Vision.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, I'm Mr. Jonathan Becker. I love having friends who are edutaining, who raise my game and inform me by what they know of what they speak and the rhythm at which they live their life. I'm not a Capricorn, but if I was, I would sponge all of it, all of what I can get from the presence of these people that we bring to you, that it is a pleasure to have in my life and share in yours. Thank you, Jonathan. As a reminder, please go for show notes to our YouTube audiovisual companion playlist. Our show is produced by Mr. Craig Snyder. The audio design production is by Michael Donaldson. Thank you, Michael. Photography, Bettina LaPlante. You can get more episodes of Sounds and Vision by going to soundsandvision.net or by subscribing to this podcast in your favorite podcast feed. You can reach me on Instagram or Twitter by finding at Luke Oldham, Facebook by going to facebook.com/AndrewLukeOldham, and to find more of the best music podcasts available to you, please visit doubleelvis.com or follow Double Elvis on Instagram, the Double Elvis FM on Twitter. Sounds and Vision is brought to you from Because Entertainment. I look forward to seeing you next week because I enjoy you. Take care, share, and as always, please remember to beware the careless word. Ciao for now.